Welcome to the Gravity Podcast, where we host conversations on developing a Christian spirituality rooted in love that fosters resilient faith in everyday life.
As sure as the sun rising in the east, it's Tuesday, and this is another Gravity Commons podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Good day.
We're not quite as sure as the sun rising in the east. There are a few times recently even where we've thought, oh, shoot, well, that one didn't work out just because something went wrong with the recording or I guess that's usually what happens. Something goes wrong with the recording and we're like, well, I guess we're all out of podcasts. So
I'm speaking into existence, Ben.
Oh, good. Manifesting?
I'm signing contracts with my mouth.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Uh-huh. Manifesting the universe. I love it. It's great.
Yeah, mostly just for you and me and Christy. Hi, Christy.
Hello. How are you guys doing?
Good.
You're sometimes I feel a little sheepish because we do this on video. We record these on video. And I've seldom showered, you know, by like 9:15 Eastern. And Christy
like
is recording this
my time.
And you're like showered and you've
got
prepped.
Like a legit blouse on.
Yeah, you're blousing it.
I got some meetings today. Mm-hmm. I got even some makeup on a little bit today. So, wow, it's really happening. It's really happening, friends.
It's going to be a great day. 7:15.
Sometimes during intros, we offer like recommendations by way of like what's going on with you? What are you doing with your life? And I'm just curious if you have any recommendations today, like maybe a movie you saw that you liked, a TV series that you're enjoying, a book you're reading. Doesn't have to be one of each. It could just be one total. So anybody have any recs?
Well, I have two recommendations.
Okay.
One, it's called It's Not Like That. It's a TV show. It's only like 6 episodes long or something. But here's the deal. I've only in like 3 episodes in. And the first episode was good. And then the second and third episode were like, okay, I'm going to stick with it. Okay. But it made me cry. That's why I said it was good.
Oh.
Okay.
Did you ever watch This Is Us?
My wife did.
Some of those. Yeah.
Okay. Both your wives, I'm sure, were like. Anyway, it hit something emotional for me that is powerful. There's some cheesiness that the guy's a pastor and his wife died. That's the premise. Mm.
That is cheesy. That never happens. No. Go ahead.
I actually appreciate it because he's got some kids and they're all processing the death of his wife differently. Mm-hmm. And like one of them is like, I'm not coming to church anymore. Mm-hmm. And he lets her, which mm-hmm. I feel like in Christian culture, sometimes it's people say stupid things, you know? And so I just appreciate maybe the posture in which he's trying to parent. And so anyway, I get nervous recommending it because I don't know how it ends, you know? I don't know like if in episode 4 it's like stupid and terrible. So I can recommend the first 3 episodes.
The first 3 episodes.
It was worth watching. It was worth, you know, yeah. I also would recommend if you have to get an electrician that you save a lot of money because electricians are expensive and they chew up your yard too, which I know is like, they're not trying to be mean, but it just, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love that you said they chew. Did you say chew?
Chew. Yeah. They chew up your yard.
I feel like I've never heard that word before, and I know exactly what it means.
Okay, what's your recommendation?
Context clues.
Ben, what's your? Do you have a recommendation?
I am thinking through that question.
I've got a couple while you're thinking.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm reading the Farseer trilogy by Robin Hobb. It's a like an epic fantasy, sort of. Has Arthurian legend themes in it. So it's not set in you know, our world. It's set in a fantasy world, but it's very much like Arthurian legend kind of lore and stuff like that. And it's really good. Mm. It's like character driven and introspective, and I like it. There's a different kinds of magic in it that are not the normal magic, sort of you know, not the Harry Potter magic, I guess you could call it. Mm-hmm. So I'm enjoying that, and my wife and I got back into White Lotus recently, the series on HBO, and we're watching season 3, and it's just really well done.
Yeah, it really is.
So well done. And Ben, you'll appreciate this. I was watching episode 2 of season 3 last night, and there's a character in this, and like, oh my gosh, what is, I know this woman. Where do I know this woman from? She looks so familiar to me. And I, you know, got on the Google machine. Mm-hmm. She was in The Leftovers.
Oh, yeah.
Corey?
Yes. Corey Coons? Yeah, one of the characters in season 3, yes, was one of the main characters in The Leftovers.
Which is also about people dealing with death.
I feel like you are talking another language because I haven't seen either one of these shows.
Mm. Yeah. Well, The Leftovers is a bit heavy and it blurs like reality and fantasy enough that you're like, you know, there's some fantasy shows that you're like, yep, this is total fantasy. I get it. And then there's some shows that are like, okay, this is all real. And then you get shows like, remember Lost, Christy, where you're like,
oh yeah,
is this real or is this fantasy? I don't know for sure.
Yep.
And I feel like Leftovers was like that. Mm. Like, okay, you're not quite sure how to categorize this in your brain, so it keeps your brain a little off balance. And then it's also super heavy, but really good.
Okay.
Really good. And White Lotus is pretty heavy too, by the way. I don't know.
Yeah, it is. It's a very dark comedy.
It's dark comedy.
Like, be ready for that. Be ready for the dark, but also be ready for the comedy. Like, I think it's funny.
So, it is funny.
Yeah.
So that's a book and a TV show rec. Ben, how about you?
Well, I have a couple things. One, because you recommended The White Lotus, it has given me boldness to recommend another dark comedy that Deb and I just watched. We just watched the second season of Beef, which is a series on Netflix.
I've heard of Beef.
About people arguing. You know, they've got a beef, you know, that it's not like cow meat. It's they've got a fight. It's a fight. And it's kind of like The White Lotus in the sense that like every season is an all new cast, like a pretty new. I mean, I guess there's some repeat characters in The White Lotus, but I don't think there are any in this second season of Beef. Just really great performances and really good writing. There are some really dark, difficult moments. So, you know, be ready for that as you watch it. But I really enjoyed the series. It ended on an interestingly poignant note. So anyway, I'd recommend that.
All right. Great.
I would also recommend, I'd like to make more recommendations. I'd like to, reclaiming my time. Okay.
Got it.
Okay.
I listen to audiobooks. I've stopped listening to podcasts. I don't listen to them anymore. I listen to audiobooks almost exclusively in my car or when I'm working out. And two that I listened to recently that I really enjoyed, one was called Clara and the Sun. I mean, these are books you can read with your eyeballs as well if you'd like, but they're also audiobooks, and I enjoyed the performance of the book. Clara and the Sun by Kazuo Ishiguro. Which is kind of a sci-fi kind of near future kind of thing. And then the other book was called Beautiful Ruins by Jess Walter. I really enjoyed both of those books.
All right.
Have either of you guys read them to you? The Theo of Golden?
No.
It's by Alan Levi. Good.
I've heard people talk about it.
Yeah, I think it's
What's
good.
What's that? What?
Theo, like the name Theo.
Oh, Theo of Golden.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah.
All right.
I thought it was delightful. So.
All right. There you go. There you go, listener.
So many recommendations.
So
if you would like something to do in your evenings other than doom scroll social media, there's a plethora of options for you.
Yep.
Although doom scrolling social media, can we bring that back?
No, never.
Was that really that bad?
Yes. Awful. Oh,
okay. Sorry, Christy. You're right.
I will concede to bring that back, Ben, if you will also concede to bringing back parachute pants and wear those.
What if I do both at the same time as bonus points? Yeah. Doom scrolling and parachute pants.
Yeah. They would make good lounge pants. Lounging, doom scrolling.
Lounging, swishing around.
One final recommendation that we have is this interview here with James McGrath. He is the Clarence L. Goodwin Chair of New Testament Language and Literature at Butler University here in Indianapolis, where Ben and I are. His blog, Religion Prof, can be found on the Pathos Network. His previous books include The A to Z of the New Testament, Christmaker, A Life of John the Baptist, Theology and Science Fiction, and What Jesus Learned from Women. Today, we are discussing his latest book, Beyond Deconstruction, Building a More Expansive Faith. Let's get into it with James. James, welcome to the Gravity Commons podcast.
Matt, it's a real pleasure to be here and to finally be talking to someone who lives and goes about life not that far from where I do the same.
Yeah, James and I are neighbors. Ben, also a neighbor here in the greater Indianapolis area. I've learned to refer to it like that. James, you tell the story of your own faith journey a little in this book, particularly about how you encountered what's commonly referred to as deconstruction. And that's obviously the focus of the book. So I wonder if you could share a little bit of that by way of introducing yourself and also introducing a bit of the topic we're going to be talking about today.
Sure. Thank you. For longer than the term deconstruction has been used, there have been people going through this experience. And really, for as long as there have been people trying to make absolutist sorts of truth claims and treating the Bible in this very modern sort of fundamentalist sort of way, there have been people who, once they started looking closely at the Bible, found that it shook all that apart for them. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that has been particularly effective or notorious, depending on your point of view, for accomplishing that is pursuing an academic degree in biblical studies, because you've been shaped by a faith tradition that has taught you to love and value the Bible and that it is the inerrant word of God. So you study it and it blows that whole thing apart. Mm-hmm. And so what I realized is that biblical scholars have been doing this deconstruction thing for pretty much as long as there has been academic biblical scholarship.
Yeah.
And it seemed as though those of us, you know, at least myself, but those of us, you know, because I'm not the only one, who have come through that process with what we would characterize as, you know, certainly not the same faith, but Christian faith, one that we think is actually deeper and more honest and more robust, we should share our journey, not as like the absolute guide. This is how you navigate these waters. You know, turn left exactly here, you know, hard to starboard, you know, when you see this rock or something like that. But just as an example of how one might do so and how one might put things together in a new configuration out the other end, if for no other reason than to encourage those who've experienced what can, you know, often be quite a traumatic experience.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I think some of that trauma that people go through in this, you know, process that we're calling deconstruction has to do with their relationship to certainty. And so I wonder if you can go into this, like how does our desire for certainty and the illusion of certainty, how does that contribute to our difficulty, the difficulty we have with this process that we call deconstruction? And like you said, it can be really traumatic, but some of the ways that people describe it, it can almost be like, why doesn't it feel like a fun discovery time? You know? And I think part of that reason is our relationship to certainty. We feel like we're not discovering something new. We often feel we're losing something.
Yeah. And if we can free ourselves from let me put that another way, because I think we all have the instinctive desire for certainty, or at least some things that we can cling to. And I'm not of the view that everything is so absolutely uncertain that nobody can know anything and that nobody can justify having any convictions. But if we can reconcile ourselves to the fact that some things, many things, will be less certain than we may have been previously indoctrinated to expect them to be, then it can actually become that fun experience of exploration. That's why I'm not just, you know, doing podcasts talking about, you know, moving beyond deconstruction, but I'm still smiling even after having gone through this experience, you know. But it's interesting. So I teach at Butler University here in Indianapolis, and we just hosted a program called Scriptural Reasoning on campus. It was mostly educators involved in higher education at religiously affiliated schools. And we were talking about this as part of, you know, education more generally, right? It's not just people who teach religious studies, Bible, theology, who bump up against the fact that students and human beings in general have a desire for certainty, right? If you think you know the absolute truth about, you know, politics or economics or history, there's a reasonable chance, even if you had really good teachers at a good education program, that something somewhere in the mix, either, you know, somebody got wrong that was teaching you, or you got the wrong end of the stick or something. And part of why I wrote the book is to help people find their way to that being something that's really positive. It's like, I learned something new, rather than I lost one of my deeply cherished beliefs, right? It's like, I'm making progress. I'm figuring things out. I feel like I've got a little slight glimpse more of the truth. And so one of the things I found myself talking with some of these other educators about in these past days was the fact that it's not a move from certainty to uncertainty, right? When we go through this process, it's a move from the illusion of certainty, a feeling of certainty, feeling certain, to feeling uncertain. And I think probably the most important step in that process, in order to go from it being something traumatic and negative to something positive, is to realize that your situation, your actual certainty, is no different. What you have is greater honesty about your level of certainty. And if there's any hope of being certain about anything, it's going to have to start with honesty about how certain or uncertain you are, how well-founded, well-grounded the things are that you believe. And so that feeling of uncertainty is the first step towards actually beginning a genuine, authentic, reasoned, evidence-based process of discovering what can I know and to what extent, right? As long as we're content with a feeling of certainty, that may be a feeling of certainty about things that we have no business feeling certain about, then for all we know, we might be completely deceived about things, right? Mm. And the Bible warns about the fact that we can be deceived. We can deceive ourselves. Others can deceive us. And so there too, there's, I mean, on the one hand, a resource in the Bible, like it's like, you're doing this thing that's actually biblical, right? You're questioning, you know, God is so important that you're going to prioritize the search for truth and not just take things on, you know, on the claim of others. Yet we always have this tendency, at least in certain faith traditions, to assume that, you know, those warnings are about those other people, right? Because we've already got the truth, right? But the only way to know that is to dare to be honest about that feeling of uncertainty, you know, and embracing that feeling and recognizing that yeah, it's going to take more than that feeling in order to have a genuine, legitimate, justified confidence in what you believe and what you value.
Yeah. Yeah, I know we could get down the road of like an esoteric philosophical conversation about certainty. but I do just want to like ask how you deal with, you know, the texts of scripture that describe certainty as something to be desired or achieved or attained, you know, being certain of what you hope for and sure of what you'll receive, those kinds of things. Do you think that certainty functions differently for those of us in an Enlightenment modern world than it did for instance, St. Paul? Do you think that St. Paul was after something that is actually not as virtuous as what you're contending for? How do you make sense of the texts? Because the people who want certainty and who claim it and who build their entire faith worldview on it can just pull scripture after scripture about why it's such a good idea.
Yeah, I think those scriptures may not provide quite as much support for their view as they claim. Of course, the fact that you have texts that say you should feel certain does not actually provide evidence that those texts are, you know, giving you the truth, right? And so just saying, well, this text says I should be feel certain, and I feel certain about this text, and therefore, you know, you can get yourself into that lovely circular reasoning that it's hard to get out of, but that, you know, if you think that your faith is something you should share with others, you have to be able to do something better than circular reasoning, right? To have a meaningful conversation with someone who doesn't already agree with you. But texts like that, you know, thinking about, you know, Hebrews, it talks about, you know, faith, and faith in the Bible is mostly about trust, right? It's rarely talking about, you know, assent to doctrine and dogma. And when it does, you know, it's like in the letter of James, you know, where he's using that other nuance of faith that's less of a focus in the New Testament. He says, yeah, you know, demons believe God is one. You know, a lot of good it does them. It's like, you know, believing the right things is not presented as something that is either as important or as meaningful or as, you know, central to true faith, right, as trust, right? Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding, right? And it's a popular memory verse in conservative churches that say, then follow that up with, but we have the Bible, so we know the truth and are not leaning on, you know, we're leaning on the Bible. And it's like, yeah, okay, but yet that's about trusting in a God who surpasses all understanding and recognizing our own human limitations and the limits of our own understanding. And Hebrews, I think, is talking about that, right? Faith, trust in one who you have reason to believe is faithful and who transcends your comprehension, but is, you know, seems capable of bringing things about in ways that you are not, allows you to feel confident about things that are unseen, which mostly is focusing on, you know, not on, you know, there's a whole, you know, celestial angelic hierarchy and you can know all their names and stuff by some leap of faith or something. You know, it's talking about confidence about things that are not yet visible, right? It's about hope for the future. It's about what is possible. And having confidence based on trust in one that, unlike yourself, has the power and the greatness to bring it about. And so I think the focus, even in those texts that seem to be saying, you know, you should feel certain, it's more about feeling certain, you know, feeling confident in God, right? And putting your trust there precisely because you recognize your own limitations.
Yeah.
Listener, if you are looking for ways to get more deeply involved in what we do at Gravity and at the same time support the work that we're doing, I might invite you to think about spiritual direction.
Yeah, Thursdays are one of my favorite days because Thursday I meet with my friend Courtney for spiritual direction. And it's a conversation that we have an hour long. And we talk about where are you noticing God's activity in your life? And we do that together.
Well, that sounds great, Ben. Could you give us a definition? What do you think spiritual direction is?
I'm actually finishing up school for spiritual direction. And that was one of the assignments, was to kind of write out your own version of it. Here's what mine is. Spiritual direction is a process of prayerful conversation that facilitates growing awareness of God's presence and involvement in your ordinary life. That invites you deeper into surrender to God's love and a fuller participation in the life that God shares with us. So yeah, if you're interested, go to gravitycommons.com/direction and obviously reach out. If you have any questions about that, you can email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com.
Man, I really want to rabbit hole down this because I think part of one of the seminal moments or liminal moments in my deconstruction was realizing that I had put faith in my faith rather than faith in Jesus. And certainty was a huge linchpin in that faith in my faith. The more certain I was, the better I felt, and the more assured I was that I was a Christian. And you do talk about this in the book, and I love the way you talk about confidence. And I think there is a metaphysical crisis for people who've learned to be allergic to uncertainty or unknowing to navigate confidence in the midst of that. Mm-hmm. It does feel like the ground of your being has been wiped away. Mm-hmm. And you do a really good, delicate, gentle job in walking through that. But there's so much more. So I want to keep moving. you organize the book with a metaphor or an analogy like that deconstruction can be kind of like a house renovation or a house rehabilitation. And you use this DIY sort of image of reconstructing faith. Can you unpack a little bit why you think that's an apt or good analogy to use for how we find a more livable faith?
Yeah, so I'm tempted to start by saying that you know how we get these great ideas in the bathroom, but no, actually, that metaphor, that image started with some actual home renovation. Like the first inklings of the possibility of writing a book along these lines was, we decided to redo our bathroom. Like the tile was old and dingy. And so said, okay, get someone here. They'll take care of it. It won't take too long. They pulled up the tile. Guess what was underneath? A whole other set of tile. And so they pull that up, and then there's the linoleum, and then there's the floor, which is not in the greatest of shape. And before I know it, if I peer through the door to my bathroom, I can see the crawl space underneath. Right. Oh. And there's all this stuff that was there and I just didn't even really know. Right. And so between that and having a roof rebuilt over our heads and somebody at one point missing a step and this foot comes through the ceiling, right? You realize that homes are, and if my wife is listening to this, she's probably traumatized by the memories that this is evoking. Sorry, darling, if you're listening to this. But houses, like worldviews, provide this illusion of certainty, right? It's like, all this stuff, all of this is set and you can just feel confident and live here comfortably until suddenly you realize that water's been dripping and this whole thing is rotted and you're going to have to tear it down, right? Or you're going to have to move out for 6 months while they try to salvage it or whatever. And that's why, on the one hand, I think that the imagery of, building and of houses in the Bible, it's like there's building on the rock, right, versus building on sand, but there's also this possibility of building with less than solid materials that Paul uses, right? And so the fact that you've got your foundation sort of in the right place still doesn't mean you're building something, sturdy and steady and trustworthy on top of it. But also, just like with houses, if you actually honestly take a look at the things that it would be easy just to neglect and don't just assume it'll be fine because it's been fine, it's always looked fine, there's a reasonable chance that your experience of living in this home, the house will adapt and you will be able to do repairs and improvements and adjustments rather than reach the point where the whole thing starts collapsing and it's really too late, right? Because a lot of what makes deconstruction traumatic is precisely the fact that you're told this thing is trustworthy, and so you keep just coming up with these ad hoc ways of propping things up and of explaining difficulties away until finally it just gets too much. And then it's not just that one thing that pushes you. It's the whole weight of these things that have been piling up. And so I think that, you know, that's why I think DIY is a metaphor. And apologies, not just to my wife, but to anyone who's actually had some experience of this. And it's bringing to mind some of those things.
Right. Yeah, trigger alert.
I recommend that. if you've never been through that, then go watch the classic movie with Tom Hanks, The Money Pit, back in the 80s. That's one that it's like, That's why when we got hired the contractors and they said, yo, this will just be 2 weeks. I knew, it's not going to be 2 weeks.
Yeah. That's helpful. I appreciate that. You know, one of the things that you explore in this book, your chapter Faith That Explores, no pun intended, you talk a little bit about how ancient cosmology of the world of the Bible, how it's so much different from our sort of modern cosmology now, informed by science and technology and a bunch of, you know, other things that we know now that we didn't know back then. And you talk about this because, you know, for many, modern science has created a problem for those who want to be faithful to the scriptures. And I think I feel like I talk about this with people in our church almost every week. There's some sort of interpretive, people are having trouble interpreting a text of the Bible. And a lot of times it has to do with feeling like I'm supposed to adopt the ancient cosmology in order to be faithful to the scriptures. Like I have to believe that, you know, we just preached, you know, ascension. And so, you know, the ancient cosmology, that's where God lived. God lived up. And of course, now with space travel, we know, okay, God doesn't live up. And we've got different metaphors for maybe thinking about where heaven is and that kind of a thing. But anyway, I'm fascinated with this issue, I think, because it presents itself for a lot of people who are deconstructing to think that if I move beyond the ancient cosmology, am I moving beyond faith in God? Do I have to adopt ancient cosmology to believe in God? So anyway, that chapter, you talk a bit about that. And I wonder if you can say a few things about how we navigate the tensions and the conflicts sort of culturally, metaphysically, between the pre-modern and modern understandings of how the world is and works.
Yeah, thank you. And I think when it comes to expressing Christian faith in the present age, that really is, in a lot of ways, the most kind of crucial question. Mm-hmm. Because there's no way to disentangle the expression of faith that we find in the pages of Scripture from the view of the cosmos that they held, right? And so, God, seated on high, right? Jesus ascending up into this language is there. And I think the first thing that, often I try to tell people is that if they think that, they hold a biblical literalist view and they've been managing to hang on to and reject science here, there, and elsewhere in the interest of preserving the gospel that's entangled with that ancient cosmology, you haven't. Right. Whether it's, meteorology and, you checking the weather report and not just and accepting that, even if you still believe that God sends rain on the just and the unjust, that, high and low pressure systems and humidity might have something to do with it and are not competing explanations. The fact that you talk about, everyone who believes in his heart. Might want to say his or her heart, and already there you're sometimes getting into dodgy ground with some people, but I'm happy to go there. But the heart, it's like, you'll say it's a metaphor, right? Paul didn't know it was a metaphor, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there was a debate, I think between sort of Plato and Aristotle about, is it the heart or the brain? And Paul seems to have gone with Aristotle, right? And Aristotle was wrong, right? Thinking was happening in our heads and not in our hearts. Mm-hmm. People didn't know that yet. But the fact that the literal truthfulness of the, sort of the anatomical understanding that was at work there is something you can no longer hold doesn't mean that the underlying meaning has to be completely discarded. Yeah. It just means that you will think about this using your brain rather than your heart in a different way. And it's not going to be exactly the same as the way Paul thought it. And there's no way of getting back to that through some leap of faith or act of the will. But that's okay, because they were expressing their faith in God through their understanding of anatomy and of the cosmos. And when we see that they're doing that, when we see that, you know, Paul talks about multiple heavens in a way that you don't get in, you know, the Old Testament or Hebrew Bible, because, you know, the Greeks had been doing this astronomy thing and had some better ideas about, you know, multiple heavens, each moving independently. Just, it's like, okay, yeah, so think about this differently. You know, use different language. He was not wedded to the scriptures that he had over against ongoing observation of the natural world. And so I think, you know, not only is it possible, it's necessary, you know, and it's liberating, even though it's also unsettling, to realize that we have no choice but to find new ways to express our faith, right? It always feels, again, it's that comfort, it's that illusion of certainty. It always feels more comfortable to be able to say, well, others have figured this out already, and I'm just going to believe what they came up with.
Yeah.
But the richness and, you know, the rewarding character of making something your own and finding a new, genuinely contemporary and nonetheless authentic way of expressing it, so much more rewarding.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there is some, I was thinking about how that is the implicit theology for anybody who believes you can preach a sermon. Right? Yeah. Because we're assuming that this letter, say we're going to preach from Romans, this letter that Paul wrote to specific people that are all dead, we're assuming that God is speaking not to them anymore through this letter, but to us. And so we have to, you know, anybody who reads an English translation of the Bible believes this, you know, implicitly, because like you said, they express their faith and they, you know, and even if you believe in a, you know, fairly robust version of the inspiration of Scripture, that inspiration came through a very specific human language that has to be translated because we don't speak it, you know? And even that, there's a work of translation that there's this distance, right? Yeah. And so why wouldn't there also be cultural distance? Why wouldn't there also be metaphysical distance? So anyway, sometimes that helps people that I'm talking with to think, oh, I already believe this actually.
Yeah.
If I believe God can speak to me through the scriptures and, you know, through somebody, through a sermon, if I believe God is actually talking to us, well, then I already believe that this distance must be crossed. And so why not cross it?
Yeah.
You know? Why not play around?
Yeah. That's, I think when you can find bridges, people realize I've actually taken steps in this direction already, right? And it was okay. And it's, you know, my worldview has not collapsed.
Right.
My congregation does not have exactly all the same problems that the church in Corinth had. And I can be grateful for that, first of all, but also I could read that letter and find it meaningful across the distance of time and space and of, you know, different context, right? Not just difference of, you know, historical setting, culture, you know, and so on.
Yeah. That's good. I think if I were to name another key question or obstacle that people encounter in their faith, it's the problem of evil and suffering. And, how can God be good and powerful and, you know, genocide be happening when Christians who are being killed are praying against it? And just no illusions here. I'm not certain, nor do I want to be, that you can resolve the problem of evil and suffering for us in 6 minutes, James. But and I know this isn't going to go away with one podcast, but I know you have some compelling things to say about it in your book, and I wonder if you would share how you make sense of a good God in the face of ubiquitous evil and suffering.
On the one hand, I think that, you know, even if we had a whole other podcast, you know, trying to sort of make sense of evil and suffering, you know, treating it as, you know, a theological riddle to be solved rather than something that, you know, it's like, say, I don't understand, but I know what I'm called to do is to offer compassion in the midst of this suffering and to, you know, and to work for justice and against, you know, genocide. I think often, you know, the approach that, you centers that hunger for certainty, you know, treats, you know, I mean, what's traumatic about, you know, evil in the world becomes less that there's these horrific things going on and more that I don't know how to make theological sense out of it, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think the first, you know, one good first step is to engage with the fact that, you know, that very reaction suggests that, you know, what Jesus taught us to prioritize maybe is not being prioritized when you have this dogma focused, you know, and certainty, mm-hmm. Certainty centering, you know, approach to faith. But unlike some of the things that we wrestle with in our contemporary world, that's one that is actually there, you know, within the Bible. And on the one hand, it inspired, you know, theological developments, right? When they had people not just suffering despite seeming not to deserve it, but being singled out, you know, and for martyrdom because they were seeking to remain faithful to what they understood God to want when, you know, others were not, at the cost of their own lives, and these people were being killed and others were carrying on merrily. That's what gave rise to, you know, the conviction that, you know, even death will not prevent God from rewarding people, right? And so the problem of evil has been generative of, you know, theological creativity and innovation in the past. I'm not sure that even, you know, positing an afterlife of rewards and punishments makes, you know, the brute, you know, horrendousness of some of the things that happen in the world, you know, not a problem anymore, right? Just because, well, you know, that everyone's going to be happy, you know, that there's going to be rewards and so on.
Yeah.
What I think, you know, I keep coming back to is the appropriateness, the need for it to have an element of mystery to it. Because I really do think that that's the focus in the book of Job, right? You know, you have stuff going on in the celestial realm that Job and his friends, none of them knows anything about this. And I think there's a lot of humor in there. And so if you miss that and treat this all, you know, in a very, very serious way, you know, you just end up with a different sort of dogmatism that I don't think is what the book is aiming for. But Job spends all these pages and pages complaining that he doesn't deserve what he's being put through, right? And saying, you know, sure, I'm not perfect, you know, but, you know, if I trying my hardest, you know, what kind of God would single out the person who's sort of trying their hardest to do what's right for all this suffering, right? There's still a problem here. Mm-hmm. And in the end, you know, sort of God shows up and talks about the weather and talks about mountain goats. And it's like, what the heck is this thing, right? And I think the key to understanding that is that this is a book in the wisdom tradition, which didn't appeal to divine revelation, right? They observe nature and there's like, yep, look at the ant, you sluggard, you know, and learn the lesson from the, you know, the lilies of the field and so on and so forth. And God shows up and doesn't reveal anything, just points out all this stuff in nature that doesn't fit into these nice, neat packages. Like, here's, okay, let's start with the stuff you don't understand, right? You know where the storehouses are for the snow. And so, and then talks about, you know, do you feed the young deer? You know, do you care for the young deer? Do you feed the young lions? What are the young lions eating? They're eating the young deer, right? I mean, this whole world is, you know, not a nice, pretty place where, you know, there's no undeserved suffering and everything is. And the book suggests that there's possibly, just possibly a reason why that sort of universe would be created by a good God, which is if everybody gets sort of instantaneously rewarded and blessed every time they do good things, right? I mean, ask my students this. How many of you, you know, would help little old ladies across the street more than you do if every time you did so, a $50 bill appeared in your wallet? And, you know, hands go up. And I'm like, okay, would it still be a good deed? And they're like, no, right? And so unless there's a universe in which we actually have to, if we're going to do what's right, have to do it despite not it benefiting us, that's the only kind of universe that can work towards that kind of moral formation, right? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, and I'm not suggesting that, you know, Job still has the problem of it reflects an ancient cosmology and ways of thinking about God. And so, you know, those problems don't go away. I'm not saying, well, just look at Job and all the problems go away. But I think, you know, the book of Job, like so much biblical literature, is wrestling in a much more serious way with these issues in ways that still, you know, have something to say to us, even as we do it in a new way in our own time, that I think is a lot deeper than what people who read and say, yeah, well, you know, it was all either they read and they think, oh, it was all Satan's fault or all of this, or, you know, they have these superficial engagements with the text as though it's solving the problem rather than saying, here's why there might be a universe in which the whole thing is so complex that you can't tie it up in a nice, neat package.
Listener, you may know that this is an entirely listener-supported podcast, and if you are aware of the fact that I just said listener twice, you will know that you are a listener and that you are invited to support the work that we're doing if you'd like to do so.
This is a big shift we made recently, going to like a fully supported, listener-supported like economic model versus people paying for either memberships or paying for things sort of bespoke in a bespoke way. And the reason why we did that is because a lot of the people who most benefit from our work are also people who economically can afford it the least. And so we're trying to, obviously, we're doing battle with mammon, with the full armor of God, Christy. I know that was a question you had. And so I think part of the vision behind this is maybe you support us economically because you appreciate and benefit from what we're doing, or maybe you support us financially because you want to sponsor and help other people to get access to what we do and for us to continue to do it. So there's a lot of ways or reasons to support and partner with us, but we thought it was good to make an explicit invitation.
Yeah, so if you want to go just from listening to actually participating and supporting, what address do we go to? What has it been?
Yeah, you can go to gravitycommons.com/partner, and there's a bunch of information there about kind of how that all works. We partner with an organization that allows you to make tax-deductible gifts. If you have any questions, you can contact us, but consider this, listener, your invitation to becoming a supporting listener of this podcast and of all the work that we do. Thanks so much for considering it.
You know, when I thought I had the problem of evil and suffering licked, what the result was, I was not able or willing to be of really any help or good to people who are suffering. You know, I wasn't very compassionate. There was no vision of co-suffering love, or lament, or imprecation, or any kind of response to evil that we see commended or even commanded in the scripture. And so, I think that evil and suffering often push people out of the faith. And one of the reasons, maybe we can wrap up with this, is because it introduces doubt, right? And this is the other side of the certainty conversation we were talking about earlier. And I'd love to hear your thoughts as we conclude, James, about doubt. Many of us come out of religious systems that treat doubt as a threat or as something is wrong. What are some ways that you've learned how to move into Christian faith that treats doubt not as a threat, but as a companion?
Yeah, I think we can actually sort of just segue from Job nicely, because the end of the book of Job, I mean, it's comedic, but it's profound at the same time, right? Job's friends have been defending God, you know, or really defending their doctrine about God. So have been insisting that Job, his sons, you know, it must have deserved this, or it'll all be okay, or these trite answers. And God shows up and first of all says, okay, you don't have this thing understood. You don't understand the way the world works. And then at the end says to Job's friends, I'm angry with you because you haven't spoken of me what is right the way my servant Job has. Like, Job was complaining, right? And Job was saying, this doesn't make any sense. And that honesty apparently is talking right about God in a way that having a nice, neat theology that explains why it's all your fault and God is off the hook does not, right? And Job is doubting the traditional wisdom, right? He says, I said these things. I believe these things, right? You're not telling me something I don't know, but my experience has shown me I was wrong. And so I need to rethink this, right? And sort of doubt about the traditional wisdom is woven into that. we mentioned earlier the warnings in scripture about, you know, not being deceived, right? I mean, it's even, you know, trust not every spirit, right? I mean, never mind trust not every person, right? And you know, that's there in the Bible. And not trusting, you know, not simply accepting without thinking, without questioning, without evaluating, that's doubt. That's all it means, right? It's not deliberately trying not to believe. It's not wanting to believe. It's saying, and this is why I think it can be a positive thing in the service of faith, it's saying, understanding as accurately as I can whatever it is that it's possible to understand about God, including understanding the limits of my ability to understand and how to make sense of myself in relation to a God that transcends my comprehension. That's so important. And it's so important not to allow myself to be deceived or to deceive myself that I'm going to ask hard questions. Mm. And I'm going to, you know, ask, you know, follow-up questions. I'm going to look for evidence and I'm going to ask, you know, what's the basis for that claim? You know, where did you get that from? Yeah, okay, you always heard that. You know, you got it from this other preacher. Where did they get it? You know, tracing things back to their... All of that is... All that's meant by doubt, but it's a positive thing, right? It's a tool in the search for truth. Doubt is not an end in itself. It's not as though it's like, I'm not going to believe anything. It's, I'm going to put my confidence, you know, when it comes to assertions about the world, about, you know, about history, about God, about anything, I'm going to put my confidence to the, you know, in an appropriate measure to the evidence available and to, you know, how much it justifies feeling certain about this thing. And I'm going to demand evidence because this is that important, right? It's not, I'm not going to believe. It's, I'm going to believe, I'm going to seek good, strong, you know, reasons for what I believe. And I'm going to be open to changing my mind because as a human being, it's always possible I could be wrong. That's humility. That's something that's woven into, you know, that's woven deeply into what the Bible teaches us, what Jesus teaches us.
Yeah, you know, the story that comes to mind, James, is Thomas, you know, doubting Thomas, who's sometimes used as a foil. And Jesus does, in a way, rebuke him. He does say, stop doubting and believe. But I also see this welcome, this openness that Jesus has to his doubts, right, to his questions. He doesn't say, your questions are dumb. He says, come and see. Put your hands here. Come and touch me. Which is remarkable because of other places, you know, the resurrected Jesus says, don't touch me. Don't hold on to me. But for Thomas, he's like, okay, touch me. Come here. Get your questions answered. Let's wrestle this out. Let's have it out, you know?
Yeah.
And then the end result is, now stop doubting. Yeah. Now, it's also fine. It's fine for you to doubt. It's also fine for you to have faith. So have some faith. Anyway, that's an interesting encounter for me to think about through that lens of what you just talked about there.
Yeah, I think it's Jesus being compassionate to Thomas, who's getting, it's like, he's the only one, according to the story, who wasn't there.
Right.
And anyone, you know, who's hearing, it's like, we saw, it's like, wait, you what? Is this some kind of joke?
Me?
This is not funny, right? And so he doesn't get something, you know, sort of extra. He gets the chance to, experience what the others did so that he's not left out in that way. And it's not, you know, well, you know, sort of woe to you because you had doubts when you hadn't seen the way the others, you know, who were sort of criticizing you and giving you a terrible nickname that you're going to be stuck with for the rest of history. It's, you know, more blessed are the, you know, blessed are those who have not seen yet. You know, there's a blessing, you know, if you can, you know, find your way to this, you know, and you haven't had access to this kind of thing, and yet you have other experiences that, you know, rock your world, and you come to believe through, you know, despite not having this kind of direct experience of encounter with the risen Jesus. There's something blessed about that, but you know, there's also a place for, you know, recognizing, we've been through a lot, and I really can't get what these people are talking about. How can this be true? You know, and you know, why would, you know, if this is true, why would everyone but me be included, right? If you're one of the 12, right? And so I think recognizing that there are some legitimate questions that would pass through your mind if you were Thomas. Yeah. And Jesus doesn't sort of rebuke him for thinking those things. He offers him an opportunity to have what the others had.
Yeah, that's maybe a good place to wrap up. I'm struck by the fact that how often doubt drives the plot of Scripture, and how doubt becomes the epicenter or ground zero for revelation and healing and new beginnings and transformation. And how I think one of the things I'm taking from your book, James, is like, I need to change. There's an opportunity to change our relationship to doubt, right? Yeah. And not see it as the problem or the thing to solve, but as the arena of encounter, you know, with the living God. This has been so rich. Before we go, I know you you blog from time to time, and I want to give you a chance to tell people where they can find you online.
Yeah. Used to do it much more often than I have been keeping it up of late. Need to get back to it, doing it at least somewhat more regularly. But yeah, I think one reason why I've gotten a few more books written of late is because I've chosen which things to. But yeah, it's online in most places, including my blog, which is on the Pathos website, is Religion Prof, sort of all one word. If you type that in and say no when Google asks you, did you mean religion space prof, you'll find me. You could also sort of type in my name and anything related to religion, you'll find me. And yeah, like you, I feel like these things are so important, and really wrote this book wanting it to be helpful and a resource to people. And so, if you're reading it and something's meaningful to you, I would love the encouragement. But if there's something where you're like, okay, but I'm still wondering about this, find me on social media, and if I can answer, I will.
Mm. Well, dear listener, if you've taken nothing from this conversation other than say no to Google, it has been productive. Listen for you.
Yep.
The book, again, is Beyond Deconstruction, Building a More Expansive Faith. James, thanks so much for being our guest today.
Oh, Matt and Dan, this has been a wonderful conversation. Thank you.
Yeah, it's fun.
James has a charm about him, like a sweetness of spirit.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Did you catch that?
I like him.
I do too.
I like him. Yeah, and always looking for charming and sweet people to hang out with here in Indianapolis.
Yeah.
So maybe we'll get some time to do that. So
one of the things that we didn't get to talk about in the interview, but he talks about in his book, is that he gets specific about how many of our many of the listeners here. I should say that I have friends who were like grew up in mainline churches and went to mainline seminaries, and the word deconstruction is actually they experience it as negative.
Yeah,
And so they were like, oh, I grew up loving the Bible and loving Jesus, and I get to seminary and people are like trying to destroy my faith.
Yeah.
And that may be you, listener, right? Mm-hmm. I think a preponderance of our audience are people who maybe had an opposite experience where deconstruction was not a welcomed visitor, but they wouldn't wish away where they are now compared to where they used to be.
Yeah. 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 There are different, that's the slippery nature of the word. I think there's a more recent use of that word that is often used by people coming out of the evangelical church world that predominantly does not necessarily mean throwing away faith. Whereas there was a way of using that term in a more academic way coming out of the mainline 50 years ago that did imply this Bible stuff is silly. You know, like that's the subtext is like, nobody believes in God anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of sneering attitude about faith is a lot of what some of our mainline friends experienced. And that's what was called deconstruction for them. It was damaging for them because of that tone and that kind of way of thinking about it. Whereas, a more recent way of using that word has to do with what we talked with James about.
Yep. Yeah. I do hope we get together with him soon. Hope to make that happen.
You're obsessed with that guy.
I do like him. I don't know. He's got like a, Ben, I tend to have a more colic personality.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Or one of our maybe kids had colic. Colicky? Are you saying that your tummy hurts?
No. No. I think people who have kind of a sweet joy about them are like the opposite of my kryptonite.
You like them to be around them.
Yeah, I'm like if there's a virtuous energy vampire for sweet, nice people, that'd be me. I just want to like trade on the operating system they're running on.
Yeah. I think that could be. Now you got me thinking about what we do in the shadows.
I knew it. I knew the danger in bringing that up for you.
Because that character Colin is so funny. But yeah, if you don't, listener, I apologize about mm-hmm. this insider banter here. But the energy vampire, he doesn't suck your blood. He sucks all the energy out of the room and sucks people's energy out of them. Mm-hmm. It's a really funny character. But I like that idea, Matt, actually, that it's like like a virtuous, like an upside down energy vampire, because you're not
taking their joy from them.
Right. You don't feed off their energy and then they just fall asleep.
They're infesting you. They're
the joy is multiplied.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was talking about this in spiritual direction today with a directee, and their work was to acknowledge and affirm and celebrate how true joy is contagious.
Mm-hmm.
And to enjoy it.
Yeah.
Joy is meant to be enjoyed.
Yeah. It's abundant. You get more of it when you give it away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's all.
Okay. That's it.
Except for this reminder, Ben. Remember that the urge to sing The Lion Sleeps Tonight mm-hmm. is never more than a whim away.
I'll keep that in mind.
Yeah, keep it in mind.
Yes.
All right.
All right, listener. Apologize that that's now going through your head. Peace.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, please tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is the best advertising. Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. To join discussions about the podcast and lots more, join us in the Gravity Commons. It's free to join, and you can connect with other listeners to the podcast to talk about faith, spirituality, and whatever else comes up. To join, go to gravitycommons.com/community. The Gravity Podcast is produced by Ben Sturkey and Matt Tebby. Aaron Sturkey edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his mixing, engineering, and production work at aaronsturkey.com. We'd love to hear from you. To record a question or a comment for us, go to gravitycommons.com/message and click Start Recording button. You can also email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com. Catch you next time.